brothers in the Dharma. Thank you, Padmadaka. So yesterday we concluded with Naropa's song of realization that began with those incredible words. We also heard them last night in the puja. Samsara is the tendency to find fault with others. Samsara is the tendency to find fault with others. Put that up over your shaving mirror or somewhere you can see it regularly. It's a fantastic saying, I think. Samsara is the tendency to find fault with others. Fault finding in other people, in the world around us, creates samsara. It actually makes samsara happen. It creates the world of dissatisfaction, frustration, and limitation. Fault finding prevents us from doing what we actually need to do, which is the reformation, the reformation, the refashioning of ourselves in the light of the actual root facts of existence, the actual meaning of the Dharma, rather than just getting into head knowledge of Buddhism. Naropa wanted to live the meaning of the Dharma. So he gave away all his books, all his belongings, and he decided to resign as the abbot of Nananda and leave the safety and security of his good Buddhist world. His colleagues and friends, the other great scholars of Nananda, tried to convince him not to go. They urged him to stay for his and their sakes. They needed him. He was a big, important monk, very good in debate at defeating the other followers of other religions and so on. But Naropa had to go. He had to leave. He didn't know where to go. He didn't know where the brother, remember the old woman said, it's my brother who knows the meaning. He didn't know where that brother of the old woman lived, who knew the meaning of the Dharma. But he knew, Naropa knew, that he had to go. He had no choice. His realization, his integrity, his authenticity told him to go. It was a crazy, mad thing to do, leaving all that wonderful position behind him, to walk into a kind of void because of the vision of an old woman, the vision of a witch speaking strange things to him. It was as if he was haunted. There was nothing he can do about it. He had to walk into emptiness. He had to walk into the void. He had to walk into the open space. So off he went, no longer relying on the scriptures and commentaries. They'd all been left behind. No longer relying on his brilliant intellect. That had been all shot through by the vision he'd had. He was just going to have to rely on his spiritual vision, his spiritual intuition. And an inner voice, it says a voice from the sky, kept telling him things. First of all, it says, well, change your meditation. Meditate on a different Buddha form. So he went into retreat. He thought, well, I'll go into solitary retreat. And he practiced this particular meditation very intensively. He recited the mantra of this particular figure 10,000 times. And then the voice told him, just announced, go east and look for someone called Tilapa. So he was going to follow the voice, and off he went eastward towards Bengal, a very important tantric centre of the Mahasiddhas. Searched around, no Tilapa. And the voice told him not to be lazy and go further east. So he plunged deeper and deeper into the Bengal heartlands. And there then follows in the life of Naropa a sequence of very strange dreamlike images in which Naropa is continually brought up against his conditioning. He meets weird people. A leper woman just lies in the middle of the road. And he asks her to get out of the way. And she said, well, no, you'll have to move me out of the way. You'll have to touch me and move me. And when he leaps over her, holding his nose, because she stinks so bad, suddenly she vanishes. And he hears a strange teaching. He meets a man who wants to kill his parents. And he asks him to join him in that task. And when Naropa doesn't do it, this man just disappears. He meets an old fisherman and his wife who serve him food, because he looks like a monk, a food of dirty frogs brought up from the marsh and other nasty bits and pieces. And every time Naropa felt squeamish in relation to this, the people would just vanish. And it's clear that all these different visions that he had were really him, the intellectual monk with the high caste background, constantly being challenged, his boundaries constantly being broken, his taboos being broken down. They're so dreamlike, these stories, it's clear that they can't be taken literally. They're about his ideas of what life is being broken, of what people are like being broken, what the Dharma is, what he is being questioned and destroyed. At last, he came across Tilapa, but not until his despair at not finding this man and not finding the meaning of the Dharma had not reached kind of fever pitch. He decided that if he couldn't find Tilapa, he'd take his own life. And of course, then Tilapa appeared. A dark man, dressed in white cotton pajamas, his black hair tied up in a knot, and with bulging bloodshot eyes. This was Tilapa. Even then it wasn't straightforward. They didn't have a kind of palsy-palsy, kind of bosom-friend relationship. After they met, and seemingly Tilapa had accepted Naropa as his disciple, Tilapa would just sit, cross-legged in meditation, just staring ahead. And Naropa would serve him and kind of worship him and attend to him. And then Tilapa would just say and do strange things. He taught the Dharma in riddles and symbols, didn't give any formal teaching to Naropa at all. And Naropa had to kind of intuit what these riddles were all about. And then they went off wandering together. Tilapa decided it was time to go wandering. And he was a very, very stern guru indeed, very, very demanding. There were sorts of strange stories of Naropa's sacrifices, as it were, at the hands of his teacher. This teacher, Tilapa, didn't have an ounce of what the Chan Zen people call grandmotherly compassion. I think you can guess what grandmotherly compassion would mean. He just didn't care what he did to bring Naropa to realisation. Just didn't care. And there's very strange tales indeed. Tilapa would, for example, just be sitting. They're near a wedding feast. A king is coming through the town. And Tilapa's sitting there and saying, if I had a real disciple, he'd go and attack that king and knock him off his elephant. Naropa would go and do it. And of course would get beaten up, savagely beaten up and broken up and all sorts of stories like this, you know. And Naropa, you know, would be lying there badly injured on the floor, almost dismembered. And Tilapa would say, what's wrong, Naropa? And Naropa would always say, I suffer because of my attachment. And Tilapa would then heal him and then unfold another level of spiritual practice, another level of spiritual experience to Naropa. It's a very, very graphic, very vivid account. Again, not to be taken literally, I think. It's definitely kind of a symbol of something. It's not that pleasant to read. I must admit, I don't really enjoy the life of Naropa. But the picture you get is of constant recreation and destruction. Constant breaking down of a notion of selfhood and a recreation of it, more in tune with the nature of things. There are suggestions, I think, with all this as well, of relationship with the shamanic vision quest. You know, the shaman will have dreams or visions where he's dismembered or eaten and then kind of spat out, broken and reformed. Of course, when we are in the throes of destruction, and it does happen, whether or not, well, I'm sure, I hope none of us have a teacher like Tilapa. When you're in the throes of destruction, when you feel that your boundaries are being destroyed and feeling that the ground that you stand on is being taken away, it's very, very disconcerting. When you're in it, you don't know how it will turn out. Of course, the stories always conclude with the disciple becoming enlightened and so on. But when you feel that everything is breaking up through the effects of your spiritual practice. You don't know how it will go. The Buddhist journey is a journey into emptiness. It's in a way a journey into nothingness. We have the idea that everything will be fine. We have a lot of expectations, a lot of hopes, a lot of ideas of how it will turn out. We'll meet this wonderful teacher with his wonderful spiritual community who will give us this wonderful teaching and method. And if we do it for just long enough, in just the right way, everything will be okay. The path is well signposted, it's nice and smooth and straight. There are all the stages and levels and signs. We will be saved. We'll enter the stream, we'll become enlightened. We'll realise the true nature of mind. Life will be sorted. We'll have lots of friends, maybe even one day disciples running around for us. It's inevitable that we have this approach. It's unavoidable that something like that will be in our mind. I remember, or am I just particularly perverse? I don't think so. I remember after I was ordained, I thought to myself, I was very young at the time, I reckon if I just do my practice every day faithfully, in a year, the bodhicitta will arise and everything will be all right. But of course, the tales of the Mahasiddhas make it clear that the journey of the Dharma, walking in the Dharma, that's the meaning of this word Dharmachari, which is the ordination you have into the order, the Western Buddhist order. Walking in the Dharma is in fact a journey into increasing uncertainty. An uncertainty that becomes more intense. It becomes more intense because on one level or another, you're beginning to experience the baselessness of existence ever more strongly. No matter how good you get at meditation, how sorted out you feel, things happen, stuff happens that knocks you over, unbalances you, wrecks you in some way or another. This is the kind of Tilapa principle, if you like, that's going to start coming into play. This is the principle of the Vajra Guru. The Vajra means adamantine or diamond hard. The Vajra Guru, Sangharakshita says, is the no-nonsense guru. He doesn't mind what he does to you to bring you to reality. Well, that, whether or not you're in touch with anybody who is a Vajra Guru, if you take up Buddhist practice, that will happen in one way or another. That's why, by the way, we've started to do the Padmasambhava mantra. He himself, of course, was a Mahasiddha. Yes, so sooner or later you're going to be sort of wrecked and unbalanced through spiritual practice. The real yogi, the Mahasiddha, is the man who lives in this baseless, empty existence. He's not a nihilist or a cynic or anything like that, quite the contrary. He lives in the great stance, capital G, capital S, which is one translation of the term Mahamudra. It can also be translated as the great symbol. All experience to the Mahasiddha is extraordinarily vivid and clear and bright and alive and vibrant because of its emptiness, because of its uncertainty and insubstantiality. It's fantastically vivid and radiant and brilliant, and he loves it. There's a Mahasiddha named Dombey Herrika. In his iconography, because of a particular story in his life, he's depicted long hair and bone ornaments and scantily clad. And he's riding on a pregnant tigress. Now, the pregnant tigress apparently is the most dangerous of tigers. Very, very dangerous animal indeed. Very, very touchy. Ferocious. Anything could happen. If you're around a pregnant tigress, anything could happen if you're actually riding on a pregnant tigress. Dombey Herrika rides this tigress. He likes it. He likes the fact, he loves the fact, that anything could happen. There's also a form of Padmasambhava, an aspect of Padmasambhava who rides a tigress. His name is Dorje Drollo, which means adamantine fat belly. He's dancing on a pregnant tigress. He's not just riding, he's dancing on the pregnant tigress. And he's a beautiful, rich wine red or maroon colour. He's got great long orange dreads, bleached out dreads, a bit like Satyajit, but much more so. Got a way to go yet, Satyajit. He's holding a vajra in one hand and a kila, a ritual knife, in his other hand. He's wearing the deep blue robe of the tantric master, but he's also wearing it's just kind of held on there, the patched robe of the monk. He's just holding on. He symbolizes, if you like, living Buddhism, therefore. That Buddhist robe, it's just there, but it just shows how alive his experience of the Dharma is. He's not settled or stuck. And he's dancing with the tigress, on the tigress. He likes her. He loves her. She loves him. He loves the uncertainty. He loves the danger. It's not really danger to him. It's complete openness. So the pregnant tigress symbolizes the empty, dynamic, vivid nature of life. Her pregnancy symbolizes the potential of that empty, dynamic, vivid nature of life. It's unlimited potential. It's Buddha nature. Traditionally, Dorje Drollo is associated with hiding, concealing treasure texts, which will be found by later generations. So he's associated, therefore, with the freshness of the Dharma, the renewal of the Dharma. So the Mahasiddha rides the pregnant tigress of existence. He loves it. He loves the uncertainty. He loves the openness. He loves the vividness. He loves the danger. He makes it a dance of transformation. Make Buddhism, or any ism, or anything, a rigid path. Trying to make life to conform to your ideas, your expectations, your hopes, and so on, it will at some time, sooner or later, rise up as the roaring pregnant tigress. And you've then got a choice, if you've got the time to make a choice. You can either ride the tigress and dance with her and live that life of danger and openness and live and open up to that potential. Or you could try to pretend she's not there. No, there's nothing going on. I'm fine. You're fine. I'm fine. And everything is falling apart. Everything is falling apart. You sometimes see that, don't you? Meet people sometimes. Of course, we do it ourselves. We're just putting on that smile. Everything's all right. And everything's falling apart. I remember, I think it was an Alan Bennett monologue on the radio. I heard it in India, of all places, on the World Service. Good program, World Service. And it was about this woman whose life was just always falling apart, always disappointed hopes. I think she was an actress, a kind of minor actress, and she could never get a part, but there was always this hope. And she'd keep saying, "I'm putting on my smiling face today." And there was nothing to smile about. Incredibly poignant. So we could do that in relation to the pregnant tigress. Oh, of course we could complain. Find fault. Well, you know, other Buddhists, they're bad. That's why things are going wrong. That's why things aren't going the way I wanted them to go. And, you know, the teacher's bad and Buddhism's bad and life's bad. And I want my mum. Oh, my mum wasn't very good anyway. Anything but ride the tigress, the smiling, roaring, unpredictable nature of existence. Of course, it's so poignant, this. It's so very poignant. Very often, the tigress starts to roar and dance when things, just after things go really well. I can remember last year, our winter retreat. It was a wonderful 2 weeks. I felt very inspired, very pleased with the way the retreat had gone. I felt I'd made some progress myself, and it was a wonderful atmosphere. I felt very contented, very blissful, and there's that feeling, great, you know, hey, you know, we're going somewhere. And then shortly after that, our own order, I'm sure some of you know about this, was thrown into controversy. People started to say and write very, very critical things of Sangharakshita, our teacher. And Suddenly I was plunged into this world of uncertainty. Personally, I felt I still feel nothing but gratitude to my teacher and preceptor, to Sangharakshita. I love him very, very deeply because I felt he's pointed out the nature of things to me. But the confusion and uncertainty that it stirred up. And I have to admit, sometimes I got really fed up. And when I heard some of the things said, I wanted to say, just shut up, or just put a lid on it, or walk away. I don't want anything more to do with this. But of course, it wasn't like that. It was about, the need was to get on this tigress, to get on this roaring tigress, get into this change, get into this atmosphere, because there's enormous potential in it. And of course, we're beginning to discover what that potential is. New things are beginning to unfold and develop. So we need to get on the tigress and dance, learn and respond to what she does, how she dances, and create in that space. Because there's enormous richness in the dance of the pregnant tigress, enormous potential. It's said that Dorje Drollo, the former Padmasambhava who dances on the tigress, embodies three great and terrible oaths or vows. Whatever happens, may it happen. Whichever way it goes, may it go that way. There is no purpose. That last line could be misunderstood. There is no purpose. Doesn't mean, you know, it's a nihilistic situation or anything like that. It means that you don't try to have expectations. You don't try to impose your will on what is going on. You respond to it. You're in tune with it. You discover the potentiality in it all. This sort of thing might be going on for you on the retreat. Never know. I mentioned a moment ago Dombey Herrica riding the pregnant tigress, scantily clad and his long hair tied up, riding out apparently into the world. This is the way Dombey Herrica decided to go out and communicate the Dharma to people, riding on this pregnant tigress. Now, Dombey Herrica was a disciple of the great Mahasiddha Virupa. And I want now to talk a little about Virupa. He's been a bit of a discovery for me these last couple of weeks, Virupa. He's a very important Mahasiddha. He's at the root of, in particular, of the main lineages of the Sakya school of Tibetan Buddhism. But really what interests me about Virupa are some of the stories associated with him. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Virupa. Virupa came from far northeast India, Tripura. Again, a very important centre for Buddhist Mahasiddha activity. The songs of the Mahasiddhas, the Charyagiti, are written in languages from the northeast, from the east and northeast, Old Bengali, as it's often called, or Upper Bhrangsha. And we might even be hearing one of those songs a bit later. Virupa became a monk when he was quite young, and he joined one of the great monasteries. And he was a very good monk. He studied the texts, he observed the precepts, and he was also initiated into a tantric sadhana of the very important Dakini, wisdom Dakini, Vajravarahi, the sow-headed Dakini. And he was a very dedicated practitioner. He practiced every day, he practiced throughout the four periods of the day, and he recited the mantra of the deity no less than 10 million times. It took many years, and there was apparently no progress. But he was devoted to his practice, so he recited the mantra for yet another 10 million times. Not just reciting the mantra, it would all take place in the context of visualization and meditation and puja and so on. So this went on for about 12 years, all this recitation, all this practice. But there were no signs whatsoever of any real progress. No visions, no insights, even said, not even a significant dream. I haven't even had a significant dream. Nothing at all. Well, as you know how it is, he got fed up. You know, when you haven't had any signs, you get fed up. And he really lost faith in it all. And he took his rosary, his mala, which is regarded as a sacred accoutrement in Buddhist practice, in tantric practice, and he just threw that mala, that rosary, into the toilet, into the latrine. Now, don't imagine, you know, the sort of toilets that we have, you know, here, even in our toilet block. You have to imagine, basically, a cesspit, a stinking and filthy cesspit. That's where he threw his beads. He threw it in the shit. Threw them in the shit, saying, what have beads got to do with happiness? And he spent the day really fed up, frustrated, in doubt, done all this practice. What for? 12 years for nothing. And he kind of mooched around, and it became evening, and he realised it was time for the evening puja, and he really ought to go and do the puja. Didn't have his beads for recitation. They were in the shit. So he sat there wondering what to do. And then out of the twilight, there came to him a beautiful woman. A sky blue woman with reddish hair, wearing ornaments of bone. She was incredibly beautiful and very strange too. She seemed to be there, but seemed in the twilight to hover on the edge of emptiness. And she was holding Virupa's mala, handing it back to him, clean and renewed. And she said, the innate purity that is the nature of mind, that is the essential Vajravarahi. She exists within, so do not look elsewhere. That is foolish and childish. The nature of mind, a wish-fulfilling gem, stripped of all mental fiction, that is the most satisfying experience. And with that, the sky blue lady vanished. Virupa had practiced for so long. He was a disciplined practitioner. He'd followed the form of spiritual practice very devotedly. His intensive meditation on Vajravarahi would have involved basic meditation techniques like the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. In other words, he would have developed calm, shamatha. His meditation would have involved reflection on the nature of existence, its insubstantiality, its void nature, its shunya nature. In other words, he would have developed vipassana, or clear seeing. He would have meditated on the fact that existence is fluid and insubstantial, like a magic show, dreamlike. And then, after that, he would have created, out of his imagination, a Buddha land, a mandala of Buddhas. And he would have imaginatively made himself into this goddess Vajravarahi in a palace at the centre of this Buddha land, in this way strengthening his sense of the illusory nature of phenomena in the most inspiring of all contexts, imagining himself as a Buddha form transforming the world. Then he would just dissolve it all away again. That's what he would have done, day in and day out, for years on end. But apparently, no progress. I say apparently, because obviously something was going on deep down. Deep down, he must have been deeply affected. But to go further, to make further progress, to have deeper realization, he has to give all that up. He has to give up the form, and he has to give up all hope, all grasping after attainment. All ideas about spiritual life have to fall apart. Of course, this is something that you can't contrive. You don't sort of meditate and think one day think, oh, I think I'll not do this anymore. No, it comes out of actual experience. It can't be contrived. It comes, perhaps it comes, naturally after a serious commitment to spiritual practice, to sadhana. Virupa falls apart. And he needs to fall apart. But he can't help himself. He's fallen apart. And he really does turn things over. He throws his mala, sacred to the Buddha form he's devoted to, into the shit, the filth of the latrine. He's hopeless. He gives up. He lets go. And in the twilight, that mysterious time where objects soften and blur and change, when form dissolves into emptiness, a goddess comes along. Not Vajravarahi, but who's red in colour, but a sky blue goddess. And her name, we're told, is Nairatmya, which means she who is selflessness, she who is egolessness, she who is insubstantial. And she's regarded as the consort, sometimes of Vajradhara and sometimes of Hevajra. In one text, Nairatmya is described like this. No form may one apply to her, neither tall nor short, neither square nor round. She transcends all taste and smell and flavour, and it is she who brings spontaneous, natural joy. In other words, Nairatmya is emptiness, voidness. She is the perfection of wisdom. And she tells Viripa not to search for reality in form. The true goddess, the true Vajravarahi, is to be found in the empty nature of mind, in the empty nature of awareness. It's in him, it's everywhere, and it's nowhere. Well, the effect of this vision on Virupa, this transformation, this transmission of voidness to Virupa, was extraordinary. He began to turn everything over, began to behave in a spontaneous way, in a natural way. He became, to quote Richmal Crompton from one of her William Brown stories, he became lifelike and natural. As he said in his Song of Realization, mine is the spontaneous reality given by the magnificent symbol, the Mahamudra, just abiding in things as they are, not thinking, not achieving, no self. And he began to act very strangely. People noticed in the monastery that pigeons were going missing. And there seemed to be these young maidens going in and out of Virupa's room, and there seemed to be the smell of drink. And once he was caught tucking into pigeon pie. And of course this was absolutely shocking in the monastery. They were very strict in the monastery. Probably this doesn't just reflect good Buddhist principles. Probably there is some Brahminical influence going on here to do with kind of purity, but kind of caste purity. Of course, again, I think we should be careful not to take this literally. And sometimes people like to, I'm going to eat meat in a Buddhist retreat centre. I'm going to booze. I'm going to get the girls in. But in our culture of license, of complete license, it wouldn't shock at all. It wouldn't shock any of us. Don't worry. We just ask you to go. Anyway. Moderation would be shocking in our culture. That's what I'm trying to do. But hey, listen to this as well. When Virupa was rebuked and criticised for this abnormal behaviour, he restored the killed birds. And he started to walk on water. So you can bring whoever you like in if you can do those things. That's the point. Anyway, these stories are not to be taken literally. They're illustrating Virupa's realization of non-duality, the emptiness of self and other. This is something I'm going to go into a bit more intensively in tomorrow's talk. But he was so weird, he was getting so strange and so odd and spontaneous in his behaviour that he just had to leave the monastery. So he presented his robes and his bowl to the Buddha shrine. And he left. He was really kind of left, and he was kind of expelled at the same time. In other words, the institution, the Buddhist institution, couldn't hold him. He had to turn it over. And he then lived a spontaneous, wandering, sahaja life. And when you look at the iconography of Virupa, he's not like many of the other siddhas who are often lean. They really look like ascetics and yogins. Virupa is fat. He's got a great big fat belly. Some description you can sort of see the rolls of fat. And he looks misshapen and ugly with great big bulging eyes. Virupa means ugly, misshaped, or distorted. It can also mean one who has many forms, but ugly, misshaped, distorted. So don't worry if you regard yourself as ugly. It doesn't matter. Look at Virupa. So don't give yourself a hard time about that or anything like that. You too live like this. But in the iconography, he's sitting with his fat gut, and he's sitting very, very easy with his great belly and his bulging eyes, and he's semi-naked, and he's wearing a kind of flower garland, and one of his hands is raised, pointing at the space, at the sky. And in fact, that finger is pointing at the sun. And this finger pointing to the sun refers probably to the most famous story of Virupa's life. It occurred sometime during his spontaneous travels, and by this time he had some disciples. You know, some people felt that they had to be with this man, even though it was very weird, very strange. And he was with, on this occasion, somebody called Kanha, the Black. We're going to hear a bit about Kanha tomorrow. Very interesting figure. So the two of them were wandering around, Virupa and Kanha, living the Sahaja life, free, easy, spontaneous, in tune with the egoless flow. And the two of them turned up in a town. And they wandered through the markets and the bazaars, begging their food. You can imagine all the colours and smells and sounds. And eventually Virupa and Kanha rolled up at a liquor stall in a rough part of town. It wasn't a nice, comfortable bar or pub or anything like that. It was just a rough shack selling locally brewed gut rot. A place for serious drinking. And Virupa decided he wanted a drink. So he and Kanha sat down and ordered a jug of wine, a jug of country liquor, from the owner of the bar, who was a woman named Vinasa. But she, naturally enough, she'd been around a thing or two, this woman. She wondered how these rough-looking, obviously penniless yogins were going to pay. So she said, well, okay, what about payment? Before you get any jugs of wine, what about payment? Virupa said, don't worry, I'll pay. And he just drew a line in the table, in the dust on the table. He said, when the sun crosses this line, when the shadow of the sun crosses this line, I'll pay, definitely. Sometimes it said that he plunged his ritual knife into the table. So the woman brought drink. You know, and she was probably a little bit concerned. These yogis, they're a bit, say no to them, they can get a bit irascible. And they looked a bit fierce. So the woman brought drink, which the yogins swiftly consumed. They just knocked it back. And Virupa demanded more. And basically the two of them just drank out the whole tavern. And the woman was having to bring more drink, and they're just knocking it back. And the weird thing was, the sun seemed to have stopped. It was there in the sky, but it wasn't moving. There wasn't a shadow crossing the line. And still, Virupa was ordering more drink. And Virupa and Kanha weren't going to be refused with their bulging eyes and fierce locks. One old, fat and ugly, the other youthful, lean and handsome, but both fierce. They even sang, or Virupa sang, a drinking song in the old Bengali language. All alone, this barmaid serves two at her home, preparing the gut rot with neither yeast nor shredded bark. The booze is brewed naturally strong, making my body tough. No old age or death for me. I saw the sign at the tenth door, so I came as a customer to get myself some. There are 64 jugs set up on the shelf. Once I make it in as a consumer, I may not leave. Hey, there's one bottle with a real thin neck, Virupa says. Pour me a strong one. Not your usual Buddhist text. So the woman Vinasa sent out for more liquor. She had to, they were drinking so much, she had to call all her friends in the local taverns to bring more booze for these two. These yogis, they can really take it. They can really knock back their liquor. And in the land, people were getting very worried because the sun was stuck in the sky. It was unbearable, and people were feeling kind of drunk as well with the effects of the sun. There was no shade. And even the king was getting worried. Why hasn't the sun set? And words reached him. Look, there's a yogi down at Vinus's bar. And the word on the street is that he stopped the sun because he's got a bill to pay. So the king, there's nothing for it. He was worried about his kingdom, worried about drought. He went down to the rough tavern in the poor part of town, in all his pomp with his flunkies and all the rest of it. And there, in the rough bar, they found the yogis boozing away. And the king approached, and he said to Viripa, "Have you stopped the sun?" And Viripa said, "Yes." "Well, can you let it go? It's causing problems." And Viripa said, "Well, I'm happy to. But when the sun goes down, I have to pay for all the wine I've drunk. I don't have any money." The king said, "Look, it's okay, I'll pay. I'll settle the bill, don't worry." The king paid the bill, the sun set, and Viripa and Kana went on their way. So what on earth does this mean? Stories of the Mahasiddhas are often like this. They don't sound very Buddhist at all. Is it, in fact, encouraging drunkenness and thoroughly immoral behaviour? Well, it's not to be taken literally. These stories take place in the twilight world of symbolism. So there's no one meaning. They're multi-leveled, multi-layered in their meaning. The tantric literature is full of what is known as Sandhyabhasa. Sandhyabhasa means the twilight language. Things are not what they seem. You know what it's like at twilight? I was walking in the reserve the other day in the twilight, and I thought, God, there's a cat. God, look at him go. It was just a stump. But in the twilight, my mind had turned it into a cat. Anyway, so we're in the realm of symbols when we read the twilight language text. And what's important is to engage with the stories fully and let them touch you, speak to the heart. They're actually given a very, very technical meaning. There's a commentary on Viripa's drinking song, which describes all those different elements in it in terms of inner yogic experience. Externally, the image of Buddhist yogins going to the rough part of town to drink liquor is an image, again, of transgression, of breaking taboo, of breaking convention. It's an image of breaking boundaries, of moving away and out of conditioning. They would have been with the people of the streets, the so-called outcasts. This is a very strong imagery, again, in the stories of the Siddhas. You often find them with so-called outcasts and tribals. Next week I want to look at the tribal symbolism a lot more. These are all images of naturalness, earthiness, images then of sahaja, the natural, spontaneous state of being, of natural freedom. And what of stopping the sun and drinking all that wine? Again, it's not to be taken literally at all. Stopping the sun and drinking all that wine is sometimes explained as describing inner yogic experience. The sun is regarded, as it were, as solar energy, the masculine principle, which is associated with compassionate, skillful means. Compassionate action. So he stops the sun. He also stops the moon in a way, because the moon is the lunar energies, the feminine. He's served by the barmaid, the woman serving the drink. He stops her as well, and they're integrated into what's called the central channel. They're thoroughly integrated and turn into great bliss. The quaffing of the wine is the experience of great bliss, the Mahasukha, the total all-embracing bliss when you unite sun and moon, when you unite the solar and lunar energies, when you unite skillful means and wisdom. It's the bliss that takes you over completely when all dualistic notions have stopped, when there's no distinction between self and other. high and low, inner and outer, wisdom and means, samsara and nirvana. And then the great bliss pervades the entire world. You notice that little detail that everybody sort of felt drunk in the land. So you feel that bliss is, as it were, everywhere, and that makes you behave compassionately. The image of drinking wine in a rough part of town with disreputable people is not only used in the tantric literature of the Siddhas. We find it employed even more thoroughly and to even greater effect, literary effect that is, in the great Persian poetry of the Sufi mystics. In Islam, drinking alcohol is strictly prohibited. If you drank and you got found out, you would break the Sharia and you would be considered a thoroughly bad and disreputable person beyond the pale of conventional society. But Sufi poetry, the poetry of the Islamic mystics, is full of the symbolism of drinking wine in the tavern, served by the Saki, the beautiful wine server, who's a beautiful young servant, whether male or female. And you would drink and sing ghazals, love songs, to the beautiful servant, and you'd dance and you'd abandon yourself. Here's a description from the great Hafiz, something many regard as the greatest of all the Persian poets, a description of a tavern haunter. Curls dishevelled, sweating, laughing and drunk, shirt torn, singing ghazals, flask in hand, his eyes seeking a quarrel, his lips saying, alas. Complete abandon, thoroughly disreputable, just like a Mahasiddha. But what is this all about, really? They're actually describing, in the Sufi text, inner spiritual experience. In fact, the tavern in Sufism is often described as the tavern of ruin. I'm going to read you a description of the tavern of ruin from a very great Persian master named Fakhruddin Iraqi. I went down last night to the tavern of ruin, but no one admitted me. I stood without, clamouring and crying, but no one heard me. Of the wine sellers there, either none were awake, or else, being no one, no one was there to open the door for me. Half the night had passed when some wild rogue from an archway overhead looked down and made a face. Bravo, bravo, he exclaimed. At this hour, you're quite senseless, in fact, crazy. Well and fine. Please tell me, what's the matter? Open the door, I demanded. Go away, he replied. Don't talk nonsense. Anyway, at this time of night, whoever would open the door for the likes of you? This is no mosque, for us always to open the door for you to dash in and run up to the front aisle, for you to dash in and run up to the front aisle. This is the Magian Temple of Ruin. Inside are living hearts, the place of the witness and candle, the wine and ghazal, the lute and the song. Money and wit carry no weight beneath these arches. Its tenants' profit is all loss, and their loss all profit. How long shall you keep pounding on this door day and night, Iraqi? For all your fire, nothing is visible but smoke. So what is the Tavern of Ruin in Sufism? It's a particular spiritual station. Sufi texts describe it as placelessness and selflessness. They describe it as the ruin, the devastation of your sense of a separate, fixed selfhood. It's the ruin of your egotism and selfishness and self-centeredness. That's what's ruined. That is what's utterly ruined. It's analogous to the loss of a good worldly reputation, of a good social standing. In a traditional society, if you went against the taboos of society, you would be lost, completely lost. People would just scorn you. You'd feel as though you had lost everything. You'd have no place, hence placelessness. The aim of spiritual life internally is the dissolution of a fixed self. This isn't self-hatred or anything like that. It's realizing that in reality, everything is, in fact, selfless. And there's no separation between you and others. Hence, placelessness. So the Tavern of Ruin is placelessness. And the wine you drink in Sufi symbolism is the wine of ecstasy at beholding the beauty of the Divine Beloved, which is everywhere, in everybody, and in everything. And you just live to respond to that. And you want nothing to interfere with that response. So the wine is selfless, blissful love, and you walk in the placeless beauty of the Beloved. The symbolism is taken even further in Sufism. The Tavern of Ruin is said to be the Khanika, the Sufi meeting house. And the wine cellar is your peer, your master or guru. Your drinking friends are your brother disciples. And the wine, the intoxicating love that comes when you listen to the songs of the Divine Beloved and when you listen to the teaching of the Master. And you have a similar symbolism from the world of the Siddhas. We know that the Siddhas form themselves into intensive communities known as gunas. Gunna means, very hard to translate, means something like gathering, group, clan or tribe. People with a very strong connection indeed. And one of the main practices of the gunna was the gunna chakra, the circle of the gunna. They would come together to evoke their deity, to feast, to celebrate their meditation practice, to celebrate their connection, to perform puja, to sing the Vajragiti, the diamond songs. So in the gunna chakra, you would give yourself up to one another. You'd let go completely in ecstatic celebration of the wisdom play of the Buddhas. It's highly significant that Sufis and Buddhists have this overlap, these overlapping traditions. There is evidence for Buddhist influence on Sufism, especially in India. And one of the things I find really inspiring about this is that, you know, Sufism grows up in that very strong theistic religion of Islam. You cannot prevent the human spirit from internalizing religion, from internalizing the spiritual life and bringing about inner transformation. One Sufi order in India, the Kshatriya order, has a lot of features which seem to come from Tantric Buddhism. It's all too easy to conceive of Buddhism as a pleasant pastime, something that you pass through but doesn't really touch you. Other Buddhists you meet offer a nice Buddhist chat about spiritual things, the witty word among the teacups. Or even that your fellow Buddhists are a kind of support group to make you feel okay. Or even just a nice, friendly group of people, but we're not really with any bite. Or that Buddhism is something that we do on our own, in our bedsit, in private. There's nothing wrong with those things. But the Sufi and Buddhist tantric traditions are telling us what a community of Buddhists could be. When we gather together, it's to step out of ourselves and to enter placelessness and selflessness. We enter the Tavern of Ruin and we risk everything. We gamble the lot so that we can experience the joy, the bliss, the ecstasy of the natural divine beauty all around you. You see it in your fellow practitioners. You see it in everything you do, in your meditation, even when your meditation's difficult. When you're talking together, walking on your own, washing up, doing puja, whatever. Even when it's tough and painful, actually, it's still bliss, really. Buddhists practice, the image from Tantric Buddhism and from the Sufi community is that the spiritual life and spiritual community is full on, passionate involvement with one another, with real care for one another. I meet a lot of Buddhists, obviously, and generally most Buddhists I meet are pretty happy, quite happy. Sometimes they're not as happy as they could be. Sometimes, it has to be said, I meet Buddhists who can be regularly miserable. And I feel it's because they haven't understood something. They haven't gained entry yet into the tavern of ruin. They haven't actually realised that they're in the tavern of ruin. So they can't drink the wine of bliss. They're like Iraqi trying to get entrance, but they're not ready because they don't know yet that it's all about placelessness. They haven't realised that living the Buddhist life is about turning outside of yourself and getting interested in what is beyond you. Other people, the Dharma is beyond you. Even their meditation can become something self-obsessed. Meditation is all about softening the self, expanding and including what is beyond you. It's about melting. That melting is happiness, is liberation. So isn't it time to enter the tavern of ruin? Isn't it time for selflessness and placelessness? Isn't it time to drink the wine? Let's listen to Virupa's song of realization, which is all about placelessness and the bliss that comes from it. Mine is the spontaneous reality given by the magnificent symbol. Just abiding in things as they are, not thinking, not achieving, no self. Saved from the pit of nihilism by spontaneous existential experience. Saved from the heavens of eternalism by absolute detachment. This reality is consummation of perfect awareness and pure delight.